You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. It's the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. It's trash day in West LA, and you know the sound. It's enough to wake you up, even if you're sleeping a few blocks away. But in the age of COVID-19, there's something different about this familiar scene. For one, you might have noticed that your trash can is filling up a little more quickly than it did before stay-at-home orders began. More time at home means you're making more garbage at home. And no, it is not just you.
We will temporarily offer free extra collection on those black and blue bins on your regularly scheduled collection days.
That's LA Mayor Eric Garcetti, who started letting you stand by your full bin if you have to dump extra bags when the trash truck comes around. But that's not all that's changed. If you've been watching closely, you might have also noticed that the same truck dumps the contents of your black and blue bins, both bins, into the same pile. KCRW's Kaylee Wells has more on what the global pandemic has done to an essential public service, often taken for granted.
The amount of trash you're creating at home has gone up. It's actually measurable. Here's Alex Halu with LA Sanitation and Environment.
We have seen an increase in the residential waste that's been collected by about 10 to 15%.
With all the safety protocols during COVID-19, the trend isn't surprising. Food workers are wearing latex gloves. Many counties require residents to wear masks when they're in public places. Restaurants are having to package all their food into to-go containers. And then there's one of the few places we're still spending time during the stay-at-home orders. The grocery store.
The thing that's probably hit the hardest has been not being able to use reusable bags anymore.
John Bagan is chief merchandising officer for Gelson's. It's one of the many local grocery stores that have stopped allowing customers to bring their bags into the store and is sending them out with paper or plastic bags instead.
Our volume is way up from where it was pre-COVID. So we have a lot more bags going out the door, especially the paper bags in particular are starting to get into short supply. We've gone through many, many weeks worth of bags, you know, even in a couple of days.
But it's not just bags. Some high-end grocery stores pulled out all the stops for shoppers in the name of customer safety. Here's Thomas Pledger, owner of Jade's Market in Bel Air.
We right away mandated and provided gloves for all customers entering the store, putting apples, for example, in sealed bags. Anything where, you know, a fruit or vegetable where you maybe eat the skin on it, we would take extra measures to put it in a container or wrap it.
It's thanks in part to an order by Governor Gavin Newsom last month that temporarily lifted a statewide ban on single-use plastic bags in grocery stores that went into effect back in 2016, which means some of the nearly 14 billion bags that were saved every year are heading back into landfill. Places like Los Angeles, Glendale, West Hollywood, and dozens of others have their own bag bans in place, so they don't fall under Newsom's order. But that hasn't stopped grocery stores across Southern California from offering those thicker plastic bags that are advertised as reusable. So the grocery bags, the masks, the to-go containers, all that new trash is starting to show up in the landfill. That's in addition to lots of bored Angelenos taking the opportunity to get ahead on spring cleaning and getting rid of bulky items like furniture. Normally, a lot of that can get recycled in our blue bins and diverted from landfill. But Kobe Skye with LA County Public Works says these aren't normal times.
We have had some of the facilities that process recyclables and green waste that weren't able to operate with the safer at home orders.
The blue bin recycling process relies on sorters in warehouses standing shoulder to shoulder at conveyor belts, picking through your bottles and paper and cans. Some of those processing centers say they can't operate with workers standing 6 feet apart, which means a lot of those materials aren't getting recycled.
Some of our waste haulers along certain routes, because of a lack of capacity, have had to send the recyclables and green waste that they were separating to a disposal facility, to landfill disposal.
Halu says some of the facilities where the city of Los Angeles sends recyclables have adapted, but they're the outliers.
Facilities shutting down created an oversupply of recyclable material, so the price to process the recyclables went up. So, for example, prior to COVID-19, there were 17 facilities that can take recyclables. Now there's only five.
He says when a facility has reached the amount of recyclables it'll be able to sort through in one day, any trucks that didn't drop off their collections are turned away and sent to the landfill. And that used to be relatively rare.
Before COVID-19, very few trucks were being turned. Definitely right now we're seeing 50 to 70% are being turned away.
The majority of recyclables aren't getting reused. And there wasn't much incentive for those other facilities to stay open anyway. The recycling industry hasn't been especially profitable in the past couple years, especially since China and the other countries that purchased our plastics have sharply dropped the number of shipments they take from us. In the wake of COVID-19, Halu says the slower recycling process and tanking plastic values as oil prices drop has made it all too expensive.
Unfortunately, the price has doubled from pre-COVID-19. What we used to pay about $70 to process a ton of recyclables, now it's going to be about $150 to process a ton of recyclables.
Plus, he says even as the stay-at-home orders are lifted, the social distancing requirements that have made recycling so much more expensive aren't going away anytime soon.
I know that COVID-19 is going to change the infrastructure for solid waste management for years to come.
Pandemic or not, the city of Los Angeles is aiming to divert 90% of solid waste by 2025. And blue bin recyclables are included in that 90%. But in the wake of COVID-19, facilities have had to make drastic changes to keep workers safe and limit the spread of the virus. And the city's diversion rate has suffered because of it. So the current infrastructure won't work long term. Sorters standing farther apart means slowing down production time and losing out on profit.
This means the feed is going to be reduced. So the facility that was able to do 500 tons a day now is going to have to operate about 200 to 300 tons a day.
But it's not all bad news. Even with the extra gloves and masks and grocery bags, even with bottles and cans getting added to the trash stream, even though your residential trash is going up, the amount of trash in many county landfills has actually gone down. Here's Halu.
What we have seen with the COVID-19 is that commercial accounts have went down by 80%, for example, at LAX.
That's a big deal because there's normally a lot more commercial trash than residential trash. So that 80% reduction in things like Delta Airlines pretzel wrappers and your office coffee filters is more significant than the 10 to 15% increase in the trash you're making at home. Plus, Halu says the pandemic might serve as the push the recycling industry needs to reform a system that's been struggling for years.
Also, I think this gives us an opportunity to work with the industry on manufacturing products that can be easily recyclable and also maybe create new venues and new technology that will allow us to capture the products and be able more efficiently recycling it.
He says it could inspire manufacturers to start making products that are easier to break down and reuse, so the sorting and recycling process is less expensive and time-consuming.
We're not at standstill. I see a positive or silver lining at the horizon. It just is going to take us a little bit of time to get there.
For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. It was big news in a time of uncertainty. On March 27th, a giant white naval ship pulled up to the port of Los Angeles.
Yeah, this is an exclusive first shot that we're getting here of the U.S. Navy hospital ship Mercy. It should be in the port in about an hour. Now, the Mercy is here at the request of Governor Newsom to help relieve the strain on hospital beds.
That's CNBC's LA-based reporter Jane Wells with the big news of the day of a big vessel with 1,000 beds available. That ship was intended to take in non-COVID patients. And when it first arrived, it was welcome news to Angelenos, who feared that Los Angeles was going to follow in New York City's footsteps. New York had become the epicenter of the COVID outbreak in the United States, with hospitals overrun by the tens of thousands of cases there. Thankfully, despite case and death numbers that do continue to go up, that overrun has not happened in Los Angeles. And more than 6 weeks later, the USNS Mercy has seen a total of 77 patients and had its own bout with COVID crew members. Here with the latest is the commanding officer of the Mercy, and we're thankful to have him, Captain John Rotruck. Captain, welcome, and thank you for your service.
Thank you. Thanks for letting me be here on behalf of the men and women of the USNS Mercy.
Well, the Mercy has 750 men and women, crew members, on a rotation. How many patients do you currently have? How many are on there right now?
We actually discharged our last patient 2 days ago at about noon, which was a very exciting moment for the crew. And that was out of 77 total that we've taken on board and transfer from local hospitals here in LA.
And so what's next? Do you just hang out? Do you leave? Are you going somewhere else?
So we're supporting a local skilled nursing facility in the greater LA area. And in addition to that, we're also sending out teams that will go to other skilled nursing facilities and support sort of on an as-needed basis. So we have a total of 61 personnel involved in both of those efforts, 41 at a specific nursing facility, and then a total of 20 others divided into four teams will go out to other facilities as directed by the state of California.
So you're going to stay docked in the Port of LA for the time being?
We have not been given a change in our mission assignment. As you know, FEMA is the lead agency for the whole government response to the COVID-19 pandemic, and they work closely with the state of California to determine what the need is and what the requirement is for Department of Defense assistance particularly. At this point, they haven't changed our mission assignment other than having us provide those support teams to the skilled nursing facilities. So until we get a change in mission, we are here.
You guys have not been immune to some of the issues that everyone else is having, and pun, I guess, intended there, because when the ship first arrived, there was a coronavirus outbreak among crew members. How was that handled?
Sure. So we sent those patients off the ship after we identified that they were COVID positive to try to minimize any potential spread. We did a very aggressive contact investigation, and those folks who were identified as close contacts under the CDC definition of less than 6 feet for more than 10 minutes, those people were also sent off the ship into quarantine. And thanks to those very aggressive efforts, we were able to contain the outbreak, and we haven't had another COVID positive sailor in more than 2 weeks now.
I have to ask you about this report that I'm seeing from Spectrum News One, where an anonymous corpsman told the outlet that the handling of COVID crew members on board left a lot to be desired. Can I read you a quote of what he said?
Sure.
I was told, quote, we were going to get tested, we were going to get temperatures checked, and none of that was done. Can you respond to that claim?
Well, it's hard to know who this individual is. I can tell you that no one in our crew raised those concerns to me, and I have many means available for our crew members to come forward to me if they have a concern that hasn't been addressed. So it's difficult for me to speak to his specific situation. I can tell you that for all of our sailors that we put in isolation and also quarantine for being close contacts with somebody who was COVID positive, we do check temperatures twice a day as a measure to kind of back up the development of symptoms to determine if somebody's getting sick.
What are you doing to test and make sure that everybody's safe on board? Like, what is, you mentioned the protocol that people were isolated. You haven't had another case in 2 weeks. I mean, what are your testing capacities?
So we test, obviously, the folks who become positive. We tested them and knew their status. In order to be released from isolation, you also have to test out and test negative for COVID. If you test positive, then we repeat the test in another week, and we sort of continue on that pathway. So you have to have the absence of symptoms for at least 72 hours, and you have to test negative for COVID, and you have to have been in isolation for a minimum of 2 weeks since you first had the onset of symptoms. So all those criteria have to be met to leave isolation. And then for the folks that we have in quarantine, they were also tested when they entered quarantine and then tested again 14 days later when they left quarantine. And of course, those folks have wound up being negative and they've returned to the crew. So we don't have anybody in quarantine anymore from having been a close contact to somebody who was COVID positive.
77 patients in and out that you've served in the past 6 weeks. Do you think the Mercy could have better served somewhere else?
You know, that's a great question, but one that I can't really answer based on the information I have available to me. But I can say with absolute certainty, we accomplished with great success the mission we were assigned to when we came here to LA. We were asked to be a relief valve for local hospitals. We were able to take every single patient that they offered to us who was within our capability to provide care. And subsequently, we've managed to provide for all those patients acute care needs here on the Mercy, and then discharge them either to home or to a rehab facility.
And as you mentioned, the mission isn't complete, right? We don't know what's going to happen in the coming days and weeks.
That is a very fair statement.
Tell us more about the Mercy, Captain. You have 1,000 beds on board. Is it basically like a floating hospital? That's what everyone describes it as.
That's exactly right. So if you were to come aboard for a tour, which of course we aren't offering in the midst of this pandemic crisis, I think you'd discover that it looks just like a hospital on the inside, with the exception that instead of nice tile floors, we have steel decks, and that our beds are actually strapped down to the deck so they don't move in the event that we're underway. But otherwise, you would find very little difference in the appearance between the Mercy and any other hospital. We have a 50-bed open bay emergency department. We have 12 operating rooms with a sterile center core, just like any other hospital. ICUs with ICU beds. One difference between us and everybody else is that we're more of an open bay concept, because the primary purpose of the Mercy is to care for combat casualties in the event of a contingency operation. And it's easier for us to manage a larger number of combat casualties with an open bay concept in terms of the nursing and corpsman management than it is if everybody had their own individual room.
We're talking 750 crew members. How did you get it staffed up for this assignment? I mean, where did those crew members come from? I know you're docked in San Diego typically, right?
Sure. So the overwhelming majority of those folks come from hospitals here in the western half of the U.S. So the regional command for Navy Medicine, which is Naval Medical Forces Pacific, provided us with the vast majority of the crew members out of their Navy hospitals here in the western region.
I guess before we let you go, I want to ask you personally, as somebody who has seen other ships really taking in a lot of issues with COVID-19, big outbreaks on other Navy ships. You personally, when you saw all those things happening and you knew that you're on this big boat, what's going through your mind?
Well, I think everybody, whether they're on a ship or not, in this day and age with COVID, is of course very concerned and very aggressively looking at how they can take measures to mitigate any potential risk to our crew members. So we were very aggressive from the get-go. Once we did have some positive cases, we were even more aggressive when we took additional measures, to include sending the people out in the hotels here in town. So it was definitely something top of mind for me and the rest of my leadership team. And thankfully, we were able to act quickly and I think avert any further spread.
Captain John Rotra, commanding officer of the U.S. Naval ship Mercy. Thank you, Captain, and thank you for your service.
Thank you, and thank you for allowing us to demonstrate the power of Navy medicine on behalf of our country here in L.A.
Well, onward now with Greater L.A. on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. From seafarers to sea sparkles. You may have seen it on social media, or maybe even with your own eyes. Glowing waves at night crashing into the shore, dancing neon blue sea foam lighting up the beach and making for a natural spectacle. The phenomenon, which is sometimes known as sea sparkle, is from tiny organisms that emit bioluminescence at night. During the day, those same creatures that cause the blue, the neon blue at night, can cause the ocean to turn red or reddish brown, what's otherwise known as a red tide. Marine biologist Dr. Michael Latz, who's with the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, has been studying bioluminescence for 40 years, and he's with us right now. Michael, welcome to you.
Well, thank you, Steve.
So beautiful to see those pictures of all those waves at night glowing. What exactly is causing the glow-in-the-dark waves?
Well, they're single-celled microorganisms that are common members of the coastal community that sometimes get really abundant. And there's so many organisms present, they discolor the water by day, as you mentioned, and they're bioluminescent. So naturally, they use flashes of light to protect themselves from predators trying to eat them. And this is just a reflex, because they're just a single-celled creature. And so anything that agitates the water will trigger the bioluminescence, whether it's breaking waves or a swimming of animals or people or surfers.
They glow as a defense mechanism, is that right?
Yes. So they feel a force of a predator trying to grab them to eat them. and they respond with a flash of light almost instantaneously, and that flash acts to startle the predator, and then the predators feed on them less frequently. Also, the flash of light can act as a burglar alarm, attracting the predator of their predator. So it's almost like the police are being called in to eat the burglar, and the victim, who's the organism, is giving a cry of help through this flash of light.
So fewer predators out there trying to eat, what are they, phytoplankton? Is that what it is?
Yeah, the organisms producing the bioluminescence are considered to be phytoplankton. They're eaten by other larger plankton who are in turn eaten by fish and other predators. So they're at the base of the food web, and they're using the bioluminescence as a way to protect themselves from predators at night.
I wonder, though, because we've also seen dolphins swimming near where this bioluminescence is happening. Why are they attracted to it?
Think of this like a minefield where there's organisms everywhere in the coastal waters. Anything swimming through them is going to make them light up. So, of course, the dolphins aren't bioluminescent, but they're swimming through the red tide, agitating the organisms, and so they light up. So it's just anything moving through them will light up, and it is like a minefield. So there are animals that have to be careful, because we know that when the bioluminescence is produced, it can act as a way for predators to see their prey. So small fish swimming through the red tide at night, causing the bioluminescence, make themselves vulnerable.
People are animals too, Dr. Latz. So is any of this dangerous to, say, swimmers who go out during the day or at night?
Well, some red tides are notorious for being toxic, in that the organisms produce a toxin that's harmful to human health. These organisms in our local waters do not cause public health concerns, especially if you're just swimming in them. But there are some people who are sensitive to the red tide, some of the substances that are emitted from it. They'll have respiratory issues. So certainly, if you are having breathing problems around the red tide, you should avoid the beach until things clear up.
Many beaches are closed, obviously. People are being discouraged or forbidden from going into the water or near the water or near the beach in an open air setting. Are you able to go and check it out despite these orders that the beaches are closed?
Well, in San Diego County, the beaches are open so that if people are safe, they can go down and view it. But here it's kind of at the end, the bioluminescence is not very good. And unfortunately, because of the stay-at-home order and social distancing, we have not been promoting the red tide, because normally everyone would flock down to the beach. But it was picked up in the media, so now we want to report accurate information about it. But for my own experience, I've taken advantage of the Scripps Pier, which is a research pier, not open to the public, but we use it for instances like this to be able to get close to the red tide. But this is something that is periodic. It will happen again. For those who missed it this time because of restrictions, staying at home, it will happen again. And then hopefully times will be safer and everyone can come to the beach to see it.
Dr. Michael Latz, a marine biologist at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography down in San Diego. Thanks for speaking with us, Michael.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, and stay safe.
That's going to do it for us today, but I want to mention another kind of sparkle. Not a sea sparkle, a you sparkle. Thank you for helping KCRW surpass our fundraising goal for the Mission Critical fundraiser. We raise the money necessary to operate this radio station. You power our media mission, broadcasts and podcasts that are smart and deliberate, news and culture programs that inform and entertain, music programs that absorb the beat of this region, a place we call home. Thank you for making your home with us. If you didn't get a chance to donate, you can do it anytime at kcrw.com/give. By the way, you can subscribe to the podcast while you're there as well at kcrw.com/GreaterLA. But again, you powered this radio station. Thank you, thank you, thank you a million times for giving us what we need to continue in our mission. Jenna Cagle, Rebecca Mooney, Sonia Geis, Matt Gillum, Amy Ta, Mario Saavedra, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Christine Comito, and Christian Bordahl make this show happen each and every day. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your ears and attention. Find some beauty today and make it a great one. Thank you, LA.